Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me and you get tired of seeing the same titles on every bestseller list, you are in the right place because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Today on my show, Callie Hart and her book, Brimstone. This novel is the follow-up to the mega bestseller, Quicksilver, which is romanticy at its best. Yes, we're going there. We're going to romance, we're going to fantasy, a world that we rarely ever talk about here on NPR or NHPR, but we absolutely should. Callie Hart, welcome to Check This Out. I am unbelievably excited to have you on the show.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm so stoked to be here. I can't wait to chat.
I just want to say, like, I'm trying to be cool here because I'm so excited to talk to you. Like, I'm just going to try to chill.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Yeah, I'm blown away by people's excitement. It's still super surreal to me. So to hear that you're looking forward to this book and the series in general, it's such an honor. And yeah, I can't wait to hear what people think about Brimstone.
It is amazing. I mean, like I said, I really focus on emerging authors on this show, and you are an incredibly successful author at this point, but it's happened in such a short period of time, and you started this whole phenomenon as a self-published author, right? We're only talking about a year and a half, so I still consider you an emerging author. That's why you're on the show today.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. It's so funny when people talk about this kind of thing with me because, you know, in some ways, yes, I do feel that way. But I've been writing since 2012. So for me, the road feels a lot longer. But yes, the way that Quicksilver just kind of like had its very quiet release when I first put it out, and it kind of, you know, floated around and did very little. And then suddenly, yes, BookTok got a hold of it. And It was astronomical, like out of stratosphere, the way that it kind of like shot into the charts after that point.
Okay, so let's dig into the books a little bit because I have a lot of listeners who are not familiar with the romanticy world, who don't know Quicksilver. What was book one, Quicksilver, about? Like, put us into this world.
Yeah, absolutely. So we begin the tale in a fictional realm called Zilvaren, which is a desert city. And we immediately meet our main character, Sarah Svane, who was a 24-year-old thief. She lives under very oppressive conditions. She is a sole caregiver for a very idiotic brother. So she steals to be able to support him and protect her family and the people that she loves, essentially. And she inadvertently steals something that she really shouldn't one day, and finds herself in hot water right up to her neck, and she's about to be executed, and she inadvertently opens a portal into a fey realm. And this is obviously where we meet our incredibly handsome, yet very surly, male main character, Kingfisher, who emerges from this Quicksilver portal and rescues her and whisks her away to a fey portal where she's immediately, you know, up to her neck in fey court politics. There's a war raging. It's been going on for hundreds of years. And lo and behold, she has power that might tip the scales in the fey's favor. So she enters into a nefarious deal, finds herself stuck in Avalia, and unwillingly and unwittingly falling in love with her captor, essentially. And yeah, the rest is history. You know, we leave Quicksilver on a very big kind of twist. Everything is turned on its head. Sarah finds herself transformed. And that's as much as I could say, I suppose.
Except we know that she starts off human. And when we find her in the beginning of book two, Brimstone, she is no longer human, right? She is half fae, she is half vampire, and she is looking out on the realm for which she is now queen. She is queen. That is where we find her in Brimstone. So what are we looking out towards in Brimstone?
Well, you know, like the dynamic has shifted massively, obviously, because she's not queen of the Avellian Fae. She is queen of the Sanazrothian Blood Court, who are enemies with the Avellian Fae and her mate. So it's a very tricky, sticky situation to be in. And this has obviously changed the relationship with her beau, or just at least made it very complicated in a way. She's a very reluctant queen. She doesn't want this power that's been thrust upon her in more ways than one, because obviously not only is she queen of a court of bloodthirsty, vicious vampires, but she's transformed into this creature that has never been seen before, half fae, half vampire. And she also is stepping into this enormous amount of power that she has not possessed before. And she has no idea how to control it. So there's a lot of tricky moving parts to, you know, the journey ahead, and it's not easy to navigate. So, you know, there's lots of conflict coming up. There's a real deepening of the connection between Kingfisher and Ceres, which was an absolute joy to write. And we've got a couple of new side characters as well. And we have Kerrion Swift returning, reprising his role as the court jester. And of course, Onyx is also around too, our little Arctic fox furry companion.
Yes. And Ceres and Kingfisher are back to saving the world, saving the realms, right? I mean, that is the good versus evil, right? The core of both of these books. And I think what resonates beyond the incredible characters and spice and love, you know, that is in the middle of this is the power dynamics and this idea of, can anybody be all good or all bad? And what is this fight for power? I mean, for me, that's what's at the core. And the sort of the fae, the vampire, Velia, Zilvaren, wherever we are, that's sort of just the setting for this main theme.
Exactly. And yes, that is a huge theme of the story as well. Power dynamics and power play through the different realms that we find our characters in, but also in between the characters as well. You know, Kingfisher's weakness, the Quicksilver that is driving him crazy is Ceres's power. You know, she has, you know, dominance over this thing that's driving him insane. And, you know, he's a very dominant, powerful character, and there's this push and pull between them throughout books one and two. So it's huge, you know, and when we're talking about, is there such a thing as truly a wholly good or a wholly bad character, I find the most interesting characters are the morally gray ones, or the ones that, you know, will do bad things in order to accomplish good. And those are questions that I kind of throw in there along the way in a subtle way. You know, I'm not trying to jam it down anybody's throat, but they're the interesting conversations that I like having with these characters. And just kind of like making the reader think, oh, what would I do in that scenario? Would I be willing to burn an entire city of 200,000 people to save a realm, you know what I mean, and kill all these people to save a realm, or those kinds of things. It's fun to kind of plant a seed and see which way the moral compass points.
But I felt like Kingfisher himself, like, he's not so vague about that. He's pretty clear. Like, I would kill anybody for you, Ceres Fane, right? Like, I will be morally gray or black for you.
Exactly. And that, I love that about him. You know, he's not afraid to, he loves his people, you know, like the people under his charge, the people of Carlisle and his friends, his brotherhood. And he loves Ceres Fane, and there's literally nothing in this realm or any other that he won't destroy in order to protect those people and the ideals like that he holds when it comes to, you know, ruling his lands, those kinds of things. So yeah, I wouldn't mess with him.
Yeah. So I just want to put a little side note out there to listeners who maybe aren't used to reading fantasy books, or romantasy, as this one is often called. There are a lot of new words and names that are sometimes hard to read when you're looking at the page. And I cannot recommend enough that you listen to the audiobook. Even if you just listen for half an hour. Well, first of all, I mean, the Kingfisher narrator is like unbelievable. Hands down, the entire book talk community cannot get enough of him. Anthony Palmini.
Yeah, exactly. You nailed it. He's phenomenal. He's such a fantastic narrator, actor, you know. And I think that's the real crux of it with Anthony, is that you are under no illusion that this is a performance. He is like a consummate professional actor, and he's like embodying this role, and he just absolutely kills it. He's a phenomenal guy. And his voice is just so perfect for Kingfisher. It was incredibly well cast. You know, I was very excited when the audio producer's podium came to me. They gave me a couple of different options, and you know, it was very clear that they were leaning heavily towards Anthony. And when I heard his audition, I was like, just don't even bother sending me the others. This guy is Kingfisher for sure.
Yeah, I mean, thank God you chose him. Like, no pun intended there for those of you that have listened and read this. But I just find it really, really helpful when I enter a new fantasy realm, right? So that I'm not stumbling over the names and, you know, Zilvaren and Saeris Fane. Like, so I know how to say all these. If you listen to the audiobook, the pronunciations are just super clear. And then you can take off on your own in the book.
Exactly. I was surprised by how many... You know, I get notes all the time from readers saying, thank God you put a pronunciation guide in the front of the book. And yes, it you know, I did do that, but it's still quite hard sometimes to, without hearing it, you know, how to sound it out. So yeah, the audio, they just did a phenomenal job. I was blown away.
So how did that come to be? Did they purchase it? I mean, this was before the book was purchased by Hachette, right? So how did it come to be?
Yeah, so I've been working with Podium for a really long time. They have published probably 10 other books of mine, audio narrations that they have put out. And I've been working with them, just been such a great partner to work with for a really long time. And when I came to write Quicksilver, obviously not my normal wheelhouse and like my normal content, they didn't think twice when I said, oh, they, you know, they were asking me, what have you got coming up? What can we do next for you guys? And I said, well, I got this thing. I don't know if you're interested. And they took my hand off before I'd even finished explaining. So yeah, they were the first ones to support this book, you know. And in general, you know, they've been such a champion for me over the years. So it was an honor and a pleasure to work with them again on this. And I knew they were going to do a fantastic job. And I'm so, so excited for people to listen to Brimstone, because it just eclipses book one in terms of performance. And it's just so, so good. I can't wait to like clip out some of the fun parts once we get past the spoiler stage of the book and be able to share those online.
It's great. I mean, you know, I thought that Quicksilver's audiobook in particular is seriously one of the best that I've ever heard. So it just was phenomenal. Let's go back to Saeris Fane, the main character, and let's talk about her. Like, let's start us off in Quicksilver. Who is she and what is her journey that we're on with her? Like, why do readers love her so much?
Yeah, when I sat down to write Saeris, you know, I've written a number of many female main characters, actually, and it's always my goal to make sure that they are these whole, rounded, unique individuals who are very fierce and loyal and capable women. And I was very aware that going into a fantasy setting, you know, that the whole, that's where the term damsel in distress comes from, is fantasy storytelling. So I really leaned in and tried to make doubly sure that she was not a damsel in distress. And obviously at the beginning of the book, she is in dire straits, and Kingfisher does save her. That is the last time that he actually, you know, saves her. And, you know, I'm really interested to see what people think of the dynamic between them moving into book two. But, you know, at the genesis of the series, we meet her. She is a 24-year-old woman. She has been on her own for a long time, taking care of her brother. She is his sole caregiver, and he is a useless moron most of the time. So she has her work cut out for her. And within the first chapter of the book, you know, we really establish who she is and what she's willing to do to save and take care of the people that she cares for. She is, you know, essentially a forge master, an apprentice to a blacksmith, and she's a weapons maker. She does this really interesting, cool job in this world that is normally reserved for men in fantasy, which I loved. You know, she's a sword maker, and that's the coolest thing ever, I think. And she's exactly what she needed to be to butt up against Kingfisher, who is a very dominant, aggressive, arrogant, moody, kind of grumpy sunshine kind of guy. And when I was thinking about who these characters were, I knew that she would have to be an incredibly strong person to go up against him. So, you know, I spent a long time trying to make sure that that was evident on the page. I hope I accomplished it. But yeah, that first chapter kind of like really sets the scene for who she is and who she is moving forward throughout the entire series as well.
Yeah, so when we meet Ceyrus, she's living in Zelvarin, which is a world, a realm of two suns. It's super hot. There's not enough water. Like every day you don't know if you're going to die or survive. And she has managed to scratch out a survival for her and her brother. And we really see her, right, sort of on her own and her strength in all of Quicksilver. And then when we get to Brimstone, we see her love with Kingfisher. And we start to see her change a little bit and that she starts to think, I thought for the first time, like, maybe I don't have to always be alone.
Yes.
Right? Like, maybe I can let somebody else in. And that's a really big, big transformation. Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it was really interesting for me to write that that part of the story, because I resonated with parts of that. You know what I mean? Like I find it hard to not feel like I have to accomplish everything. And it's certainly the case with Ceyrus that it's scary to let people in and hand off, you know, responsibility and vulnerability, like being open to allowing people to become a teammate in a way, you know, because it's scary for her to say, okay, I'm gonna not be the primary like defender of this other person, or I'm gonna allow myself to soften a little bit and let down some guards and defenses because I now have this partnership, this blossoming partnership with a mate, but also with a family. That these people are her family now, which is a huge part of book one and massive in book two, that this is a real found family scenario, which was lovely to write.
Yeah, and even I love there's this great, amazing scene in Brimstone where Kingfisher keeps laying out dresses for her. And he's like, you know, you don't always have to be in your battle leathers. Like you could, right, wear a dress one day.
Mm-hmm.
And she has this moment of like, I could wear a dress. Like, not that she needs a dress, but it's more symbolic of I could change, right? Like, I could be more than just a fighter every single day.
Yes. Yeah. And the fact that he gives her room to do that without, you know, there's a scene in the book where he speaks to her about it because he's very gentle in the way that he kind of introduces this idea to her, but persistent as well. And they finally discuss it at one point in the book. And she's like, are you trying to domesticate me? You know, I'm worried that that's what's happening here. And he's like, absolutely not. I'm just offering you the opportunity to soften because I've got you. You don't need me. I know that. But like when you do, I'm here and I've got you. And that's a huge thing for her to accept and allow, you know. And he takes her over to this flower, this bouquet, like this growing flower in the blood court, and shows her the flower, and it's beautiful, and it's like the most exotic, gorgeous thing in the room. And he says, this is, you know, absolutely stunning, but it's so deadly, you know, one touch will kill it. And just because you wear a dress doesn't mean, and you're pretty doesn't mean that you're not lethal. And I just loved that moment between them and his, like the analogy of it really made sense when I was writing it. And I think, you know, to her, it unlocked something that perhaps we might see develop in future as well.
Okay, we are going to dig into Kingfisher next. If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. If you or your book club have read any of the novels featured on the show, send us a note or a voice message. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Our email address is books@nhpr.org. My guest today is Callie Hart. Yes, you heard that right. Callie Hart, who wrote Quicksilver, is back today to talk with us about Brimstone. We've been talking about Ceyrus Fane, who is the main female protagonist in these incredible books. Let's talk about Kingfisher. So interestingly, you said that he comes and saves her, right, for the first and only time when she's, you know, run through with a sword and she's on the edge of the Quicksilver. But in a sense, she has saved him too, right? I mean, she unlocks that portal. So in that moment when they meet, they've literally saved each other.
It's so true. Yes. And he's very reluctant in saving her too. When you finally get to his POV and you kind of realize what's going on in his head, he's not really keen on doing it.
Yes.
Which is hilarious to me.
I know. You know, when I went back and reread it, I was like, what? This doesn't make sense. But that kind of goes along with his grumpiness.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, this the scene that you get his POV in that moment is actually a bonus chapter. I'm kind of losing track, if I'm being honest, about which edition has which bonus chapter. But yes, it's called The Maze. And I think it may actually be in the digital copy of Quicksilver now. If you re-upload it, I think you have access to it. But it kind of shows the moments leading up to where Kingfisher realizes that the portal is opening. And he's in quite a dire situation himself. So yes, you're exactly right. That moment is very pivotal for him too, and it does save him. So it's mutually beneficial for sure. He may not feel that way in the moment, but yeah, you kind of get an insight into his mind, like his mind state too, at that point, because he has known for a long time that Ceres is going to show up in his life and change everything for him. And he's kind of been reluctant about it anyway. And when he goes through the Quicksilver and he finds this broken woman on the ground, he's horrified to realize that she is human and not Fae, because his mother was an oracle and foresaw Ceres and, you know, wrote him a whole book about her and all of this stuff and drew her. And when he sees her on the ground, she has no pointy ears. She is not Fae. He's like, what is going on? My mom is never wrong. And he's like, I'm just going to leave her here. And then he feels bad and he does take her. But it is a huge moment for him too. And it was really nice to be able to show like where he was at that point, how fundamental it was to his storyline that he went through this portal too. It was kind of like a rebirth for both of them.
Yeah, I mean, he is a character. I mean, first of all, he's like this handsome, dashing, right, character that is like physically attractive to Ceres. And like the way Anthony reads him in the audiobook, like he is hot, right? There is no question. But at the same time, he has this really deep level to him and this journey that he is going through too, because he has been tortured. Right. I mean, since childhood, and literally is infected with this Quicksilver. So let's talk about his journey and this Quicksilver that is stuck in his eyes.
Yeah. He's been through the ringer. Yes, he sure has, poor guy. But it is a key part of who he is. You know, he has this firm belief that he has been put on this earth, this realm of into this realm of Avelia as a vehicle to protect and save people and serve them, and doesn't really truly believe that he has any other value other than in that way. So, you know, from childhood, he's experienced incredible trauma. He's lost his mother. He's got, like, you find out a lot more about his past and his history and all of the things that have affected who he is and made him into the male that he is today. And it's quite harrowing, honestly, you know, and this introduction of this female, this human woman, then this, you know, queen all of a sudden really puts him on the back foot, because it gives him pause where he's saying to himself, I'm not supposed to enjoy my life. I'm not supposed to have something beautiful for myself, because my purpose here is to suffer so that other people don't. And that's really hard for him to accept. It feels very, very selfish, and it's very difficult for him to allow.
Yeah, I mean, he literally sacrifices himself in Quicksilver, goes into the maze for, I forget, hundreds of years. How long is he in the maze?
110, yes. Yeah.
Literally living through hell, moment after moment, like killed back to life, killed back to life. And then, you know, Ceres shows up and he finds love. But he's finding comfort, he's finding companionship, he's finding that he can settle into himself, right? Like, it's okay to be morally gray.
Yeah.
And to sort of grow on his own journey. And I just found it so compelling.
Thank you. Yeah, he really struggles with that because he's afraid to allow himself to have happiness and joy and to like want something for himself, because then that makes it harder to pay the cost, you know, pay the price of the things that he thinks he needs to accomplish by himself. And that's a big through line through the story as well. You know, the fact that he has this brotherhood around him, this companionship from his Lupopralia, where they're like, you do not have to carry this burden by yourself. And also similarly, Ceres feels that way too, you know, she's had such weight of responsibility on her shoulders as well. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, situation for both of them to be in, where they feel like they can perhaps relinquish, you know, the weight that they've been carrying, the yoke around their necks, and share the burden a little bit.
Yeah, because really that's what these books are about, Quicksilver and Brimstone, right? We are following Kingfisher and Ceres on their journeys together. But let's talk about the titles and the elements themselves. So we have Quicksilver and Brimstone. So what are they?
So I knew when I started writing the series that I wanted to use an alchemical, like an alchemy-based magic system, which I hadn't read before. I'm sure it has been done before, but I personally hadn't discovered it. And I was so excited to kind of try and create something fun and unique for myself. And when I knew I wanted to use portal magic, and it made perfect sense to me that obviously the portals would be made out of quicksilver, which is one of the alchemical substances, and boughs of the Tria Prima, which is part of alchemy. There are three different boughs of alchemy. And yes, so quicksilver is another name for mercury, which, you know, a lot of people have tinkered with to their own demise over the years. And back in, you know, the 16th, 17th centuries, people were messing around with mercury a little too much. They were trying to transmute things into gold, and they were playing with a substance that drives them crazy. And that was a huge part of the story, obviously, with Kingfisher, because he was exposed to this mercury, this quicksilver, without a relic, a magical kind of like shield to protect him from its nastier properties. And it was absorbed into his body and has become a part of him, essentially, a part of his mindset as well. And he, you know, it kind of is represented in his eye, and it shifts and wildly creates all of these cool geometric patterns and things like that. And it whispers all kinds of ridiculous things into his ear at all times and is driving him slowly mad. So, you know, it's interesting to me when I'm creating this story that this thing that's driving him crazy and could be his downfall is the one thing that Ceres has power to affect. This transmutation, which is a huge part of alchemy, you know, evolution, changing one thing into another.
Because I just want to be clear. So Ceres is an alchemist. She also hears the quicksilver. It's speaking to her, and she can manipulate it, which is like a huge power that nobody else has.
Mm-hmm. I should probably explain that, shouldn't I?
I know that we have listeners who have not read it yet.
Yes. So that I'll start at the beginning there. So she is an alchemist, and, you know, magic hasn't existed in any real way in Zelvarin for many, many centuries. And it is outlawed, and she has been afraid of this power that has like shown up in her, in this way that she can hear the resonance of metal and affect it. And when she goes to Evalia, she discovers that she is an alchemist and that she has power over this quicksilver, in that she can change it from a solid to a liquid state, which opens portals throughout the realms. And the portals have been closed for over 1,000 years. So the fact that she can now open these gateways between other realms is, you know, the magnitude of this is shocking. So she's a very important tool as she goes into Evalia. And of course, our nefarious King Bellicon wants to use her to his own nefarious ends. So, you know, there's a lot of people who would use her and her skill sets for their own benefit and their own power. And Kingfisher is among them, unfortunately. You know, again, he's a morally gray character, and he will sacrifice, he will make decisions that other people would find morally wrong in order to protect the people he loves.
So we have Quicksilver is at the heart of the first novel, Quicksilver, and it is in the heart of Brimstone also. But when we get to Brimstone, we find this other, what do you want to call it, element? What is Brimstone?
Brimstone is another element of alchemy as well. It is sulfur. It is sulfur is represented as brimstone in alchemy. And it is yet another layer of Ceres's power that she is now discovering. You know, it is also iconically represented as like molten lava or this kind of like fiery substance. It's very, very dangerous. So, you know, there are other implications to that too, which is really fun.
I just love this parallel, right? We have these you know, what would you call it? Powers, these elements that she manipulates, yeah, right? In order to save the world. And they're a part of her. They're like inside of her. And I want to talk about the runes that she has and the tattoos that are all over her, because this is, yeah, part of how she comes to manipulate them or sort of get to know them. Let's talk about the runes and tattoos. I guess we're going to start with runes and the importance of those.
Yes, they are linked to her mate bond tattoos, which she shares with Kingfisher, which are a different kind of marking on her body and his. And her alchemical shield is permanent. But a lot of the other tattoos, especially that Kingfisher has, they are mobile and they kind of shift under his skin, changing depending on his emotions and, you know, the fate's whims and, you know, the things that they're trying to accomplish at the time. And he can pass them to Ceres as well, which was a really fun part of writing Quicksilver and book two as well.
But the symbol of marking your body, right, and getting these, whether they're mate tattoos, they're runes, they're shields, they're all kinds of symbols, their bodies are physically marked. And those marks change. There's a lot of symbolism in that, right? A lot of metaphors. Why all the tattoos? Can you talk about what they mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a very tattooed woman. I just love, you know, and making a decision to get a tattoo and what it means and what it looks like is also very important. But to these characters, you know, it's a real representation. They're not just like expressions of, you know, self-expression. They're a path and a journey and a history and a perhaps prophecy of who this person is, what they have accomplished or what they will accomplish. Their fate, you know, Kingfisher does, as I say, have sacrifice tattooed onto his body. So, and that one, you know, we discover in book two that tattoo never changes. That is a permanent tattoo for him, which is unlike any of the others. So, you know, they're very symbolic and it has real true meaning to the story. And they're also, you know, foreshadowing and clues to what's to come. So they're really useful kind of tools for me to tell the reader and, you know, the other characters in the story who this person is.
I'm so excited that you have visuals coming because I can, you know, you describe them very intricately in the book and I have in my head sort of what they might look like, but I am dying to see whatever visuals you have coming out. Like that must have been so much fun to put together for you.
Yeah, I actually hired someone phenomenal to do it for me because I do love graphic design, but there are limitations to what I can accomplish. And I'm so thrilled to see this coming together. It's going to be like a video and oh boy, it's fun. I'm hoping I can share it on release day, but I'm not sure. So it may already be out by now, but we'll see. I'm very excited.
So we should note for listeners that we are actually recording this interview before release day. So there are some things that might be coming that I don't even know about yet, but I am in. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Callie Hart, and we are talking about her brand new novel, Brimstone. Brimstone is book two in her series. The first book was Quicksilver. If you haven't read or heard about these books yet, go out now, buy them, get them from your library, however you can get to them. They are so good. And I also want to say for listeners and for people who are new to romantasy, what is so much fun about Quicksilver and frankly, this community with lots of these romantasy books is the number of people that get involved to the level that they are making art and they are putting up on Instagram reels or all over the place, right? Pictures of how they think Kingfisher should look or Sarah's Fane. And so you can watch these like 10-second shorts that random artists make of like the day they met, right? Or all these other moments. Like, let's talk about that book talk community and like how much fun that is. What's that like for you?
I mean, it's wild to, you know, I open up my apps on a daily basis and I see things and I'm like, wait, that looks so familiar. And then I get 10 seconds in and I'm like, oh man, that's like someone's made that for my book, which is, you know, the most humbling experience. It's such an honor because, you know, people put so much effort and energy and they spend such money on these things as well, which is just insane to me. Never in a million years did I think that would be the case. I just love seeing how creative people are and the artwork how talented people are, you know, like it's wild. And I love that I get to share that with people and that, you know, something that I created has inspired that level of enthusiasm and creativity in someone else is just beyond, you know, such an honor. I just did a shoot a couple weeks ago with a couple of actors in LA, who, you know, peripherally like represented a couple of scenes, and I've cut them together into some teasers that I'm sharing right now. And the response has been insane. You know, it's so fun to get to do that kind of thing, you know, and share it and not use AI. You know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that as a huge part of what I love to create and what I really admire and respect is human made art and humans creating cool stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, when you put Quicksilver down or Brimstone, when you finish these, like your experience with the book, my experience with the book did not end. And then once you start and you get into that algorithm, right, day after day, I'm seeing more and more art around your books. And it really is this amazing community. Like we're not just leaving the characters behind anymore. And people are interpreting them and picking up on what they love. And I am so curious to ask you, like, what is resonating with you? What are people coming back to you with that is most surprising?
I'll say I was most surprised by the wild enthusiasm that people have for Kerrion Swift. You know, I knew he was going to be, you know, entertaining to a degree, but because, you know, I wrote him with my own kind of silly sense of humor to entertain myself while I was writing the book as well. But I had absolutely no idea. And seeing people act out his scenes on TikTok is just the highlight of my day. It just makes me laugh every single time because, you know, like when people get two or three people together and act out these moments and use the sound clips from the audio and it's just silly and fun. And I just love seeing that stuff.
Kerrion Swift. Oh my God, I love that you brought him up because literally my next question is about Kerrion Swift because I also love him. So he is, can you describe him in like a sentence or two? Who is he?
So, you know, on paper, he is Cyrus's ex-boyfriend, but he is so much more. He was a vehicle for me to introduce levity into very tense scenes. He obviously plays an iconic fundamental role in this series once you get to end of book one, and I won't say what that is just in case anyone hasn't read it yet, but you know it when you first meet him, he's annoying, he's got a level of sass that you would want to punch him in his face for, but as you go on he grows on you like mold and you can't help but love him a little bit. I think, you know, he's just got a comeback and a snarky response for everything. He's just a ridiculous character that you can't help but love a little bit. And, you know, his character development and story development in book two, I loved being able to give more information on him and a little peek behind the curtain of what goes on in his absolutely crazy mind.
Yeah, but he's a character who's been hiding in plain sight, right? He's literally been glamored, so people don't know who he actually is. And he's been living in Zelvarin for like 1,000 years or something, right? Like super long time hiding, mm-hmm. hiding. And so finally we get to see him come out.
Yeah.
Does he get his own book? Are we going to see more of him?
That's the goal, you know? Like, I'm contracted for 3 books right now. I'm halfway through book three. I'm having the best time writing that. And I know for a fact that I would love to write his book.
Yes!
But we just have to see. If you guys are still reading by the end of book three, then maybe I'll get to do it. So fingers crossed.
I mean, I can't imagine we're not still reading. We want the Carrion Swift book.
Okay.
I can tell you now.
We'll get started.
He's funny, and he is. I love, there's this one moment in Brimstone, I think, that really sums him up, where he is climbing out of a sewer or a tunnel or something, and he's with Kingfisher, and he, like, sort of pretends that he needs help getting up. And Kingfisher is like, you know, I can't believe you survived if you can't even get out of a tunnel by yourself. And he's like, of course I can. You just fell for my act. And that sort of summed him up, right? Like, there he is, underestimated and humor all at the same time.
It's so true. Yeah, that line, I was excited for that line in particular. He comes out during that scene. He's like, you treat me like the court jester, so that's exactly what I'll be. And that's what you expect of me. How do you think I survived here for so long? You know, like, that is a huge part of it. He does hide in plain sight, but he's a very capable human being.
Yeah.
Well, not a human being, you know, like, he's super, super capable, but because he acts the fool, you know, people underestimate him and overlook him. He gets away with an awful lot than people initially think.
There's no rule book for the authors that are writing these books about fae and vampires, right? They're not real. And yet, there are some traditions, should we say, that every author adheres to, right? So how long does a vampire live? What is your rule book for this?
Yeah, I think, you know, my inspo for this kind of story comes directly from Tolkien. You know, like, I think someone said recently, all fantasy stands on the shoulders of Lord of the Rings. And that is so, so true. And there's so many tips of the cap in Quicksilver and Brimstone for Lord of the Rings. You know, it's such a treasured property to me. And I have definitely, you know, borrowed some like phonetics from language, for instance, from Tolkien for the Fae language, because he, you know, created this insane entire, like, structurally, like, you know, correct language for the Fae that was just had never been done before and has never been done since. Such a true, remarkable mind. Yeah. Yeah. He, you know, no one will ever accomplish anything like what he did with that series. Like, insane. But you're right. There's no such thing as canon when it comes to fantasy, because it is all fabrication. So you get to go in and put your own bent and twist on things, which is so much fun. You know, like, there's lore in here that I have taken from very old, you know, like, Victorian for the Fae and vampire and things like that. Ideas around what the rules of operation for the Fae and the vampires are. Like, for instance, vampires can't cross running water. That is, like, a very, very ancient, like, you know, around the idea of vampires. And similarly, the fact that the Fae won't tell you their true names, and the Fae, you know, are tricksters and will trick you into making bargains to their own ends. So I employed those to my own purposes, but then I created, you know, other little strange nuances that were unique, that I think are unique to me, I don't know, but the fact that vampires are corrupted Fae, you know, and they've got this kind of blood curse over them, and being able to create, like, my own ideas around the fire sprites and the water sprites, the selkies, and those kinds of elements that I liked to weave in as well. And in book three, I've gone, you know, crazy with it, which I love. I've got some really interesting other elements coming into book three as well. So it's just such an open door to for you to be creative and take what, like, cherry pick what you want, you know, from lore and history. It's such a fun genre to write in.
Yeah. I mean, so I think this is also something I really want listeners to take to heart, is that in this romantic-y category, and romance, dark romance, whatever you're writing, like, one of the big things that categorizes these books is they come out quickly. Like, the readers are voracious. And the writers often, right, have these stories embedded in their souls and they pour out. So, you know, whereas some books might take 10 years or whatever, that sort of cadence doesn't really happen in this world of romantic-y.
Yeah, I think there's a real pressure on us as well, in fairness, to our defense, that, you know, the readers are so voracious that, you know, there is a very heavy pressure on us to be able to to knock out these very large books very quickly. And it's our pleasure to do that because we're invested and we want to, you know, get the story out to people as well. But it's scary, you know, like, you know, you don't want to let people down. You don't want to make them wait too long. So yeah, there's a level of anxiety to it too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Brimstone did it. So I have to say you knocked it out of the park again. I can say that you end on an incredible cliffhanger. Brimstone ended. And like, literally, I was like, no, I was reading on my Kindle. I was like, page forward, like, no, did she just leave us there? Right. And I will say, right, the best line ever, right? Kingfisher, do you trust me? Like, whoa.
Yeah. I know there's going to be a lot of questions after the end of this book, and a lot of people are going to be very upset with me because that is a monster cliffhanger. And I was quite gentle with everybody at the end of book one, but I was not with the end of book two. And I apologize sincerely for that. But yeah, that was the point where the book had to end, I'm afraid.
Is there a pub date for book three? I mean, talk about piling on the pressure, even me asking you that.
You know, the goal always is to make sure that, you know, it's going to be the same time next year. Essentially, that's the goal. Providing all the stars align. And, you know, it's always a moving target until it isn't. You know what I mean? And it's hard to, like, give a firm date on that. But my goal, you know, all being well, is that it's going to come out the same time next year. But that is not in blood. And it is not a promise.
Okay. And I'm here for it when it comes out. Callie, you've had an amazing publishing journey, you know, before Quicksilver and now with Quicksilver. What advice do you have for new writers?
I've been asked this a lot recently, and I always give the same answer, and that is just to sit down and start, because we all have that imposter syndrome, that nasty little voice in the back of our head that's telling us, you know, why do you think you have the right to tell a story? Why would you think that you can create anything good? You know, people are going to laugh at you and judge you, and it's going to fail, and you're going to be a huge failure, and all of the other noise that goes on in the back of your mind when you think about, because it's a very vulnerable thing to do, to share a book. But the only thing you can do is sit down and start and do it, and be patient, because it's a long game. And my grandfather gave me the best advice. He said, you can only fail if you give up. So I clung to that, and it got me through. I think without that piece of advice, I would have given up a long time ago. So he did well by me with that.
Callie Hart, thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out. I have absolutely loved our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, this is perhaps one of my favorites. Don't tell everyone else, but I've had such a lovely time. You've asked such interesting questions that I haven't been asked before. And that's always such a joy when doing these conversations. So I appreciate it. Thank you for reading and thank you for having me.
Callie, you just made my day with that. Thank you again. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books that we're talking about this season. Thanks so much for listening. Read on.